Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. My name is Lois Weaver. The respondent's name is Dr. Harry Wexler. The date is July 26, 1982. The conclusion of the interviews that we have done with Dr. Wexler. Now, Harry, there's another section here. What other information would you like to cover or add? And I'm sure you've had some thoughts about all this dialogue between us. And what would you like to add?
Well, I think as a Jewish person, we're always conscious of being a Jew, no matter what our practices may be. I can't help but think that in my medical school class of about 76 students at Duke University, four of us were Jewish, at least four of us.
How many students were
about there? 76. Mm-hmm. And four of us admitted to being Jewish. If there were others, I'm not certain. The dean's daughter was also a member of our class. And she had married a Jewish boy, so we always counted her about a half Jew. And I think that there was no question about this great discrimination that we all grew up with.
But how did you feel about it at that time?
No, I don't know how that affected us. I think that we, I'm not sure that we hated it as much as We determined to succeed. I think it instilled a determination to succeed. I can remember so well that when I was a member of AZA and Bear came to speak to us, I just don't recall his first name. He was the vocational guidance director of B'nai B'rith. And I remember his speech so well that he gave in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. I don't recall the occasion, but he said that we had to be gold to pass for silver. And that sticks in my mind. I really hadn't thought about that until we started to discuss that now. I
have to be better to get ahead.
Right.
You're bringing up AZA. What does that mean?
Well, the Office of Olive was a... We didn't discuss this at all.
I don't think so.
Junior B'nai B'rith that I think our ages were 15 to 21 years of age. It was a... those were formative years, and the amazing thing is that it has meant so much to me in life because one of my dearest friends, Ben Barkin, was assistant executive director of AZA. Ben's about 8 years my senior, but he came to speak in McKeesport, Pennsylvania when I was about 16 or so. And we started up a friendship which has survived to this day, and just more than a friendship. I mean, and we're as close as we can be, I guess I would have to say, if we could be family. He would certainly consider me that, and I would consider him that. And through the years, people around Ben who were in AZA have been friends of mine. I have a whole host of them in Milwaukee and elsewhere. Sam Bieber was the founder of AZA. He was originally from Omaha, Nebraska, and Sam moved to Chicago, and Helena and I would see them on occasions when we visited Ben in Milwaukee for some special event. And Sam is now dead, but recently we were with Helen when we went up for another affair, Helen, his wife. So AZA was important in that respect from the friendship it offered me. I also think that it was excellent in helping us to develop and to probably form some of our thoughts and help us with seeing ahead and things of that sort.
B'nai B'rith today does quite a bit with vocational guidance. Was anything done at that time?
Yes. Isn't that awful? I guess it's Max Baer, is his name, was the head of vocational guidance, and it was a very strong arm of B'nai B'rith. We have to recall that this was the heart of the Depression, and there wasn't much that one could offer as far as developing vocations. People were fortunate to have a job. So. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't guide you with your medical choices?
No, none of that. No, but we went to conventions and meetings and really developed friendships across the land that were very enriching. The program, they called it the Fivefold and Full Program. It consisted of religion, social service, athletics, forensics.
And what was that again? Religion?
Religion, social service, forensics, and athletics.
Why, it was in effect a fraternity. Did you belong to other fraternities?
Not as a, not in, in those years.
But in college?
In college, I was a member of the Zeta Beta Tau fraternity.
Which was Jewish?
Which was Jewish, okay. Yes, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I would say at Duke University, probably with a student body of about 4,000 to 5,000 people in the undergraduate school, maybe there were 160 Jews, and about half of us belonged to the fraternity.
Would you give me those numbers again?
About 160 Jews were in the school, and about half of that belonged to the fraternity. I'm talking about men.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole other kettle of worms with the women.
Right, and then there were women, and they had one sorority.
They did.
Yeah, 85. It was very limited as far as social activities were concerned, but it was true of the South in general, not so much that they were so bigoted as was their customs.
Did you belong to a fraternity in medical school?
No. There were medical fraternities, but none of the Jewish boys belonged to them. And I can't say that they were really very strong. They didn't have a fraternity house.
All right, now, this is all additional information. Is there anything else you want to add to this?
Well, I think that we ought to pursue this business of anti-Semitism.
All right.
I think that, I do think that we develop a sort of immunity against it. We almost accept it for fact.
Are you talking about 1982?
Well, I'm talking now. What we've experienced over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can honestly say that I have suffered because I'm a Jew. I think I've been very fortunate in being able to do what I've done and being accepted by everyone. I think that I can understand anti-Semitism, and I think that most of us can. And we have learned to live with it. The one thing that bothers me worse than anti-Semitism is a Jew who's a bad Jew. I think that's an intolerable situation.
What to you is a bad Jew?
Well, someone who does little to acknowledge his heritage and offers very little to support it. This does not mean religious practice. For instance, I can give you is that I think we may have mentioned that I'm a director of the McKeesport National Bank. It was suggested that to me by the chairman of the board that we may put recommend so-and-so to be a member of the board who was a Jew. Who is a Jew. And I really opposed it, because I said to this chairman, I said, you know, I can live with bigots and anti-Semites, but I can't live with bad Jews. And I thought that it would have been an insult to our Jewish community and to the people who deal at the bank who are Jewish to have put this person on the board.
Because he was a bad Jew.
In my mind, he was a non-giver, he was a non-contributor, not only physically, financially, but sociologically, and he's a respected businessman.
Well, did it bother you that the chairman of the board said, we're going to put this man on the board because he's Jewish? I mean,
No, that didn't bother me that he said that. He didn't say to me that he's Jewish.
He didn't say that.
He knows. I mean, it's a fact. He's just Jew. And he wasn't put on the board.
Mm-hmm. You blackballed him.
Well, I really didn't blackball him. I just said that I thought it was an intolerable situation and it would be an insult to our customers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the type of thing that bothers me. I think that, I'm not sure that we can do much to change what is almost an inbred thing in people. I think that our non-Jewish friends have been able to cope with it much better than they have in the past. I think it's almost like a disease that you develop some immunity to, and
mm-hmm.
I think this has been true of our non-Jewish community. I do think that.
You think they're coming along?
Yes, I do. Oh, yes, and I think that there's a lot of reasons for that. There's the socially and financially, of course. We have been successful. And we're accepted
for the achievements.
Yes, I think. And then the situation is such that to support some institutions, Jews have to be solicited and accepted. So it works in that way.
So they're accepted for their achievements and for their generosity.
Right, and for the fact that they're needed to support all levels of society.
Uh-huh.
Not only speaking about Jews, I have to think of my years in the South when I saw actually two cities. In any town, there was two cities. It was the white city and the black city.
Mm-hmm.
And today, to go down there, to find that this is all merged and that people mingle and sit together, this is an amazing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So there has been a lot of social change in your lifetime.
Well, in our lifetime, right? Probably, you know, talking about this, probably the whole development of the world there's been nothing comparable to the period in which we've lived, as far as the leap into space and time, so much has been done.
Mm-hmm. You've also seen a great change in the fee structure in medicine. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's a. I can remember when I was an intern at the Western Pennsylvania Hospital in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was the center of lobar pneumonia. I don't know if you're well aware of that or not, but we had more lobar pneumonia, yes, than any place else in the country, possibly the world. I'm not sure of those figures, but we had pneumonia wards, and they were still present when I was a resident, because this was the first...
Now, when was this, Harry?
1947-48.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we did not do chest x-rays on some of those patients because it cost $18 to do a chest X-ray. And we diagnosed it purely on clinical and historical grounds by using our stethoscope and so on. I mean, this would be malpractice today. And we treated these people with penicillin, which was available at the time. Of course, within a short period of a year or 2 years after that, when we were going to pneumonia, was unheard of. But this was, a thing as third-party payers such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield were essentially unheard of in that time. They did exist. But we, we bent over backwards not to spend the patient's money, and one of the prime, I guess, rules of medicine is don't kill a person with kindness. But that's a fact. So if we think about that, that's
financially.
Well, you know, sometimes you say, I don't want to hurt you, so I'm not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so a good doctor will say, just don't kill a patient with kindness.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about the tremendous increase in the cost of medicine. I became interested in this and did a paper on it, which I did not publish, but which I gave about.
Where did you give it?
At in Pittsburgh, and it dealt with, I think, around 1981. So those were my figures. And actually, the inflation keeps on going. It to what I say is historical. But at that time, about $200 billion a year was spent on medical care. This included all aspects of care. The amazing thing about this has been, and I'm sure you're aware of this, which everybody is, the development of high technology. And here we talk about CAT scans and doing sonar studies, nuclear medicine, which is a new field. These are all involve high technology. The amazing thing about this cost of high technology is it was only 10% of the total medical bill. So it amounted to about $20 billion. The great cost was in low technology, like doing x-rays, blood tests, just the run-of-the-mill laboratory tests. And they're probably, now physicians will defend their position by saying, well, with this day of ever-increasing cost for malpractice, and there's no question about this, I mean, malpractice is an albatross that's around all our necks, and I don't mean us by just medical people, but I mean the community as a whole, because we all suffer for it. Somehow or other, malpractice has to be brought into under control. I don't know how that can be done, but the courts have to sober up somewhere along the line. But doctors claim that they do a lot of these things to protect themselves. I really don't think that that's the case. That may be more of an excuse. We have a tendency to order everything without thought, and then looking at the chart and deciding what the patient has, forgetting to look at the patient. Myself, I kind of play a game with my residents, and I can't do this anymore because now drugs cost too much. But I used to say to them, you got $5, now treat the patient. And it's an altogether different ballgame.
How long ago did you do that?
a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
And even now, like if I have a conference with my students, I'll say to them, you got one test to do. You're only allowed to order one test. What do you want to order?
Mm-hmm.
So we try to raise their level of consciousness as far as that goes concerning that. There's no question there has to be a change in the deliverance of health care, and it's going to come. Hospitals are just way out of line. I mean, think that, I don't know if I mentioned this before, that the new children's hospital is going to run about $900 a day. I don't remember if we could mention this here.
For each patient?
For each patient. Yeah, this is when new children's hospital is built to spend it. Now, that's really ridiculous. That's meaningless. You know, try to bring something like that into focus is really impossible for us to comprehend. And I myself am interested in this, and I've been active at the West Penn where I chair the committee on special unit care. What we're looking at now is self-care units. And this would be a minimum of nursing and supportive care to people who are not sick, but yet who need some hospitalization. So it would be kind of like dormitory living or hotel living.
What percentage of patients?
Well, I discussed this with the nurses. They feel that a large number of people would qualify for this, maybe a third of the total hospital population. You know, our patients go from being very ill to less ill because we need intensive care units for them, and then they recover. And then when they do not need this level of care and cost, which it involves, that they are receiving. Of course, this is hard to get a big industry like the medical industry turned around to think in these concepts. Even in our own institution, when I mentioned this, the financial people just pull their hair out because they say, well, we won't get our regular per diem from Blue Cross. We can't survive. Well, what has to happen is that third-party carriers like Blue Cross and other big insurance carriers have to say to the hospitals, we'll subsidize you if you will carry on such projects. There would have to be pilot studies and things of that sort.
What project?
To develop self-care units.
Oh, I see.
Now, I think this would... The other thing that's happening in medicine is that hospital stays are becoming fewer and fewer, or less and less, the number of days that one has to spend in a hospital, or in fact does not have to be admitted to a hospital. A good proportion can be handled as ambulatory patients, whereas previously these would be admitted to a hospital. So this in itself will reduce... this in itself would be a great reduction. Let me give you, for instance, we treat malignant condition of the skin, which we would call lymphoma cutis, which is a form of malignancy. If I take a patient to admit to the hospital, which I formerly did, to work him up or her up, requiring about 3 days of hospitalization, it runs about $1,200 to $1,800. If I have our office people line up the studies that have to be done on an outpatient basis and just time everything for the patient, including seeing us and doing certain studies and biopsies, it can be accomplished for about $300 or $400.
This is in direct contradiction to what you were just saying a little while ago, that with Children's Hospital, the new Children's Hospital was going to cost $900 a day.
For inpatient care.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm talking about handling this patient as an ambulatory person. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, or other hospitals haven't come up to those figures yet. I certainly think that we're well over $200 a day.
Being West Penn.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that's happening is, the traditional care of people was you had private patients and so-called indigent patients. This was an indigence made up the clinic population, which it was somewhat heroic or great feeling of satisfaction, I guess, that one participated in the clinics, gave their time freely and took care of this population. This was also the population which students and young physicians learned from. They constituted the patient load for universities and teaching institutions. Well, this is now coming to pass. I think the day of reckoning has arrived. We're going to stop, or actually, if we don't, it certainly will come to a stop, this double tier of patient care. I mean by the separating the indigents off from the private patients. These are all going to be merged. First of all, the states pay us decent fees for physicians to care for these patients. I must say that in Pennsylvania, the fees are grossly inadequate, but I'm sure that that'll become corrected. And
fees for caring for indigent patients.
Right. The so-called public assistant patients.
Uh-huh.
And now we're merging these into our practice, and we've done that with dermatology at the West Penn. We're kind of a pilot study in that respect. We've been treating these patients in the office, just like we would any other patient. We're about now into our fourth month, and I must say it's working very well. I think the girls in my office are pleased with it, and I think that we're pleased with it, and the patients certainly are pleased with it. So there's no question that the old conventional clinic is going to be a thing of the past. In my office, I use all the patients for teaching. By that I mean I don't hold them out as examples, but I certainly have my residents and people who are with me see patients, whether they be so-called private or the so-called indigent patient or clinic patient. So we treat them all alike. And the patients don't seem to mind. In fact, I think they, most are very cooperative and seem to like it. As I said, that the residents see all these patients, whether they are fee paying or not, it does bring back my uncle, who has now been dead almost 30 years, Dr. Fisher, who I referred to before, who his fees were $3, and not only that, this included the medication. He usually gave the patient the medication too. He rarely sent out a bill. If you didn't give him the money, the fee was probably never collected. So.
But that was low even at that time.
Yes, that's right. I mean, usually I think
the
going fee was $5 in those days, right? But that was his way of doing it. Of course, he was a bachelor. I might say he did all the work himself. He never had any help to assist him in the office, and he really lived in his office.
What about, I won't ask you what your fees are, but what are the standard dermatology office visits today?
Well, I would say that in this area, the first visit is about 40, and returns are about 20. It's a little misleading. We may think that fees have gone up considerably. On the other hand, the level of care has improved so much that patients require fewer visits and less treatment.
Especially for acne, isn't it true?
You're right. Well, that's going to be now with the new drug that's coming out, if it holds to what we believe it will be, we will treat most acne patients in 12 to 16 weeks, and that'll be it.
What did it used to take?
Oh.